Did you see the photos in Rolling Stone? My teenage son asked me the other day, and he wasn't talking about the provocative pictures of Rihanna on the cover. He was talking about the photos inside from the war in Afghanistan, extremely graphic pictures of Afghan civilians allegedly killed by a group of American infantrymen, a so-called kill team. The group's mission seemed to be to kill Afghan civilians for sport. The soldiers were members of the 5th Striker Brigade, and the story recounts how they allegedly staged the killings, planting weapons on civilians to make it look as if they were threatening the soldiers. Then the story says the soldiers took the photos and shared them with their friends and family members. We're going to be talking about this story for the next few minutes, and a warning to our listeners, the content of this segment is disturbing. Mark Boal won an Academy Award for his screenplay for the film The Hurt Locker. He wrote the Rolling Stone story headlined The Kill Team, and it's in the new issue of the magazine. He joins us from NPR West. Mark, welcome.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could just describe some of these pictures for people who haven't seen them.
Well, they are pretty graphic. The first set of them, and by the way, these were all photographs that were found on the hard drives of soldiers who were deployed to southern Afghanistan. What many of the photographs depict is their daily life on base and interacting with the local populations. But what some of the photographs also show is dead bodies of civilians that this particular platoon targeted for execution. And in a particularly difficult set, you see several soldiers posing over the body of a young man who we believe was 15 years old at the time that he was killed. And the soldiers are sort of hovering around the body as if it was a trophy, the way that a hunter would pose with a trophy deer, say.
And as you said, these photographs were passed around among soldiers and to their families, actually. So it seemed to be fairly open, not really a secret that this was happening.
The Army had portrayed and continues to portray these crimes, which they are prosecuting, as the work of a rogue unit that was operating more or less in secret without the knowledge of any of the unit superiors. And what we found is that it was, first of all, common knowledge within that platoon that there were soldiers going around killing civilians, but that also the platoon's supervisors had ample reason to be suspicious. They, in fact, were suspicious that something was amiss and did nothing to stop it.
Why didn't any of the higher-ups do something to try to stop this if they knew about it?
The platoon sergeants had a very tight grip on that unit, and I think there was a reluctance to really drill down and confront them. But, you know, I don't really know. I mean, that's just a supposition because it's something that only those men can answer, and they haven't spoken about it.
Mm-hmm. Do we know from some of the soldiers who've been charged as to what caused them to start doing this?
Well, I think that really does go to the heart of the matter. You're dealing with a group of soldiers that was bored, angry. They had been in Afghanistan for quite some time, for I guess 6 months when they started doing this. And the brigade that they were in had taken quite a number of casualties. And at the same time, I think they felt very frustrated with their mission and their ability to actually find the enemy. The Taliban really specializes in kind of ambush-style tactics, which makes it very difficult for U.S. troops to actually engage them directly unless you're talking about special forces soldiers that go out on these very focused missions. And so for the average soldier that is somebody who grew up hoping to be deployed in a combat situation and who trained specifically for combat, it can be a very frustrating environment when you're driving around every day and looking for the enemy, and the enemy never appears except to hit you, attack you remotely with IEDs. So these guys were angry about that. And I think at the same time, there was clearly a very high level of racism in that unit. And the soldiers talked about how they didn't really regard the Afghan people as worth protecting, certainly not worth dying for or worth getting injured for, which I think also contributes to this sort of dehumanizing way that they looked at the Afghans. Hmm. And you sort of combine the frustration with the racism in that unit and add in the fact that they weren't really that well supervised. There's really clear failures of supervision here. And they were able to plant weapons on Afghans, shoot Afghans at, you know, close range, and then concoct fabulous stories about how whoever they just shot was really a Taliban attacker. And you put all that together, and at the same time they were working under a commander who was incredibly aggressive. I shouldn't say incredibly, just aggressive. And so there may have been a false sense on their part that the command environment would look the other way.
So what you're talking about here is this was Staff Sergeant Calvin Gibbs, who you name in your article. He was popular. Actually, right now, I believe his case is pending, and the other soldiers involved are working on some kind of a deal to testify against him. But he was sort of the ringleader here, and he was actually the one who suggested taking trophies from the bodies of the Afghanis who were killed.
There's some truth to that. He was definitely one of the more active participants. I don't know if it's really fair to say that he was the ringleader or that there was a ringleader, because it seems like different groups of soldiers at different times were involved in different incidents. Although he was clearly a provocateur and encouraged the activity, it's not quite the case that he was sort of controlling all the other soldiers. Mm. He may have been the spark that lit the fire, but there were a lot of other people involved.
You know, there are also some videos. One of them was shot with thermal imaging. And in this one, it's grainy footage, but there it shows two people who are said to be Afghans suspected of planting an explosive device. And it shows them being blown up by an airstrike. One of them tries to run away, and you can hear soldiers commenting on what happens to him. Let's listen to a bit of that video. And in this excerpt, you can hear soldiers cheering here over music that they added, and they call this video the Death Zone. Mark, it seems like this is very much like a video game.
Yeah, a couple things about that video. I'm not sure that it's from that unit, but the reason we included it in the sort of editorial package is that it was found on the hard drives of these guys, and to kind of make the point that this very violent material gets passed around and sort of does get transformed into a sort of entertainment among the troops. But look, it's not the first time in the history of war that soldiers have, you know, celebrated killing the enemy. It's actually part and parcel with what happens in every war. So that piece of it is not, you know, shouldn't really surprise anybody. But I think what is disturbing is that when you combine that very natural reaction with the information age and the ability to add music to a video and kind of turn a combat video into something that feels like a rock video, and it gets passed around over and over again, that certainly says something about the mindset of the soldiers in Afghanistan and the way they view the Afghan people.
And Mark, a corporal named Jeremy Morlock is at the center of your story. His video confession has been in the media. He's already pleaded guilty to murder charges, and he is serving a 24-year prison sentence. Four other soldiers, we should say, are also charged. But you describe Jeremy Morlock as someone that the Army might have rejected if it didn't need so many troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. And as you write in your story, even after Morlock joined the Army, he was charged with disorderly conduct for burning his wife with a cigarette.
Well, he is a guy who had a, let's say, a controversial upbringing, in the sense that he was always getting in trouble and getting into fights and crashing his car and getting drunk and so forth. And it's quite likely that he would not have been admitted to the Army, say, 15 years ago. But what's happened over the course of, since 9/11 is that the military has had difficulty keeping its recruitment targets. You know, I think that that's one of the contributing factors to these kinds of war crimes, is that if you look at the crimes closely enough, they usually involve kids who probably should not be given automatic weapons and sent to a foreign country.
Now, you interviewed him from his jail cell in Washington State. Is he remorseful?
Well, I think he is now. What's really interesting is that at the time that he made his first video confession, which was literally a couple weeks after he had just shot an Afghan civilian, he was sitting in a little office on a military base and being interviewed by people who he more or less would consider colleagues, men roughly his own age, but who worked for the Army Criminal Investigations Unit. And when they were talking to him about the crimes, he seemed, you know, he spoke about them in a very casual way, in a sort of non-committal way, as if to say, you know, to them, what's the big deal? And you could see the soldiers who were interviewing him try to hide their shock and kind of go along with the sort of casual tone that he was advancing. But again, that sort of speaks volumes to me about the attitude within the unit and the kinds of things that are were thought to be permissible in that corner of the war, where you're, you know, really pretty far from any oversight.
I mean, he was basically 21 years old and very young when he went over there as well. So I think, you know, we are talking about young men here for the most part.
Yeah, young men in extremely remote, out-of-the-way villages in Afghanistan, where they're hundreds of miles from any sort of civilization, thousands of miles from any cultural reference point that, that the kids might have grown up with. And faced with you know, a population that doesn't really speak English and, you know, has traditions and so forth that are completely alien to most American kids, and some of whom are trying to, you know, kill you. So it definitely creates an environment of distrust and hostility, and it's just ironic since the soldiers are meant to be there to protect the local population.
That may have been what they were going through. Maybe it distorted reality for the soldiers involved. But I'm wondering about these photos being widely circulated to people back home and being available on computer hard drives and whatnot. Why didn't somebody back home say that this is a problem and try to do something about it, did they?
Well, there was actually the father of one of the kids who was involved in all of this. A gentleman named Chris Winfield did try to take some action. His son had emailed him on a Facebook chat and said other members of his unit were murdering innocent Afghans. And Chris Winfield, the father, who happens to be a veteran himself, picked up the phone and called his son's headquarters in the United States. But it was a fairly brief phone call. He lodged a complaint with a desk sergeant or something like that. The complaint was never followed up, and the individual soldier asked his dad after a few days to leave it alone because he was afraid that if he blew the whistle or made too big a deal about it, the other soldiers in his unit would kill him.
Do you know, Mark, how this is resonating in Afghanistan? Certainly, you wrote in the article about you know, the concern when some of the killings first occurred. Now that these photos have been published, do you know how it might be affecting people in Afghanistan?
Well, I know that the Afghan president, Karzai, talked about the photographs in a speech, which I found puzzling because clearly the imagery is something that would be upsetting to anybody, whether they're Afghans or Americans. And it almost seemed like Karzai was disseminating the information when 8 months ago he had been working very hard to keep the photos out of the media. So I think, unfortunately, the article may have become a bit of a political football. You know, it also coincided with the burning, roughly speaking, with the burning of the Quran and that preacher down in Florida. So that sort of eclipsed it. But there was a lot of concern, I think, within NATO and within the rest of the coalition that the article could potentially, or the photographs themselves could potentially spark riots in Afghanistan. But so far, that doesn't seem to have happened.
Mark Bowles' story is titled The Kill Team. It's in the new issue of Rolling Stone. There's a link at our website, hereandnow.org, and we should say again, the photos that go with the story are disturbing. Mark, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.